Hello, everyone. This is Bill Von Nahar with another edition of Moments in History. American History Magazine, October 2019, has a section called Deja Vu. And usually the articles talk about something that is current in today's society that has that harkens back to earlier in time. So this is written by Richard Brookhiser. Richard Brookhiser has an article under Deja Vu called Pass the Bucks. He begins with, Americans want presidents who are leaders, that is, special. Plus, we also want presidents who are like us, average. So every presidential campaign sees a round of passing the bucks, with wealthy candidates explaining away their good fortune, in both senses of the word, while rivals blazon it. Sometimes hijinks ensue. Senator Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, the socialist who runs as a Democrat, turned out to be a millionaire. Critics pounced. I wrote a best-selling book, he snapped. If you write a best-selling book, you can be a millionaire too. Democratic frontrunner Joe Biden labels himself middle-class Joe. Yet he too belongs to the Millionaires Club, thanks in part to a multi-book deal. Sniffs Adam Green of the Progressive Campaign Committee. Joe Biden is the opposite of someone who will challenge big corporate and moneyed elites. But Green's candidate, Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat Massachusetts, is, yes, another millionaire, thanks to her own bestseller. First novelist toiling in Brooklyn walk-ups ask, when do I cash in? Though President Donald Trump would seem exempt from poor-mouthing, even he wants to be seen as self-made, claiming he scored one scant loan from tycoon father Fred, duly repaid. Then a New York Times expose showed how, over many years, Trump funneled multiple millions into his high-rolling son. The gaudiest attack on a candidate's wealth, detailed, vicious, hilarious, was the first. Its target, Martin Van Buren. The eighth president truly could have called himself middle-class Martin. The great Virginians all have been born to the manor born. Years of lawyering and diplomacy had made farmer's son John Adams prosperous and cosmopolitan, qualities he passed on to son John and fellow President John Quincy Adams. Hardscrabble Andrew Jackson had struck it rich upon moving to the Mississippi Valley, then what is known as the American West. Van Buren, by contrast, grew up in Kinderhook, a Hudson Valley town whose inhabitants spoke Dutch. He is the only president whose first language was not English. Father Abraham was a tavern keeper who, in Martin's words, lacked the spirit of accumulation. To earn his keep, the youth had to leave school at age 13. One of his first jobs was dog's body at a law office. When young Van Buren came to work in clothes spun at home by his mother, his boss lectured him on proper appearance. The boy took 2 days off. When he returned, he was wearing the same outfit as his employer. Ever after, Van Buren dressed at or above his station. When he graduated from law to politics, he stumped New York in snuff-colored coat, orange cravat, pearl vest and hose, yellow kid glove, and white trousers, unconsciously setting himself up on a world of hurt. Van Buren, the politician, might have been dressing rich, but he was sticking up for New York's common folks, who, thanks to numbers, the state was the nation's most populous by 1810, were a political bloc worth counting for. As their champion and tribune, Van Buren became a power broker in the new Democratic Party. Andrew Jackson made him a protege, first the Secretary of State, then Vice President. In 1836, the dapper New Yorker followed Old Hickory into the White House. The panic of 1837 blighted Van Buren's term out of the gate. Banks failed. Urban mobs rioted for flour. Conditions slowly improved, but when the time came for Van Buren to stand for re-election, he had two factors working hard against him. One was his opponent, William Henry Harrison. An Indian fighter and occasional territorial governor, Harrison had a resume that allowed his supporters to depict the candidate as a frontiersman, living in a log cabin and drinking hard cider, when in fact their man's dad had been a Virginia planter and a signer of the Declaration of Independence. The other hazard in Van Buren's path was a vintage Democratic Party ploy. Andrew Jackson had campaigned against John Quincy Adams for extravagance, on the fact that John Quincy Adams installed a billiard table at the White House. Van Buren was in line for a karmic payback. On April 14, 1840, Representative Charles Ogle, from the Whig Party of Pennsylvania, rose in the House to object to an appropriation for alterations and repairs to the President's house and furniture. A symphony of criticism followed. Ogle's speech, which took 3 days, to deliver, began with a survey of the White House grounds. The Pennsylvania mixed facts presented in the worst possible light with grotesque hypotheticals. Ogle ticked off all the flowers in the White House garden, relishing the exotically named blooms, Enchanter's Nightshade, Adler's Tongue, Lizard's Tail, False Foxglove. One of Van Buren's nicknames was the Fox of the Kinderhook. Ogle then alleged that Van Buren planned to gussy up the grounds with temples, pavilions, lakes, fountains, and 200 or 300 pieces of Italian statuary. Out of a factual survey of expenses for maintaining the White House lawn, Ogle spun this fantasy. Van Buren, maintaining the White House, had constructed a number of clever-sized hills, every pair of which, it is said, was designed to resemble and assume the form of a Amazon's bosom, with a miniature knoll or hillock at its apex to denote the nipple. Conducting his imaginary tour into what he called the presidential palace, Ogle visited each public room, detailing carpets, chairs, mirrors, and mantelpieces. The climax was Van Buren's dinner table, set with gilt dessert china and sterling silver plate purchased from a Russian diplomat. "It is time," Ogle intoned, "the people of the United States should know that their money goes to pie for their plain, hard-handled Democratic president, knives, forks, and spoons of gold, that he may dine in the style of the monarchs of Europe." Worse yet, Van Buren dared own tinted glass finger cups. What, sir, will the honest Democrats say to Van Buren for spending people's cash on foreign green finger cups, in which to wash his pretty, tapering, soft, white lily fingers after dining on omelette souffle? Whenever possible, Ogle invoked log cabins and hard cider and the fuss that Democrats had raised over John Quincy Adams and his billiard table. Who does not remember the indignant burst of eloquence that were then launched forth with this haul against gambling, waste of time, neglect of public business, and extravagance? Ogle beat his theme like a gong. Democrats once pretended to be simple folk. Harrison actually was. Van Buren stupendously was not. Ogle published his speech far and wide. The average voter could not untangle his minutely acute reportage on the actual White House from his lost-in-the-cosmos imaging of how Van Buren lived. However, the average voter did not know that Van Buren dressed like a dude. So the muck stuck. That autumn, log cabin beat green finger cups 234 electoral votes to 60. Harrison succumbed to enteric fever in April 1841, a month after his inauguration. Charles Ogle succumbed to tuberculosis that May. Van Buren marched on until 1862. Omelette souffle, evidently agreeing with him. Class Kabuki had breathed the longest unto the present day and no doubt will live as long as democracy itself. Van Buren biographer Ted Widmer laments the class warfare is dishonestly waged as against Van Buren by the party of privilege. One remedy for false class warfare might not to be practiced class warfare in the first place, but don't count on it. And that's the end of the article by Richard Brookhiser, who article was entitled Pass the Bucks. That was in the American History magazine, October 2019. We have another article, altogether different, obviously, that's in the History magazine, June, July 2019. And it's entitled Harbison's Honey, Liquid Gold in the West. Melissa Stark Rodenberg looks at the life of John Harbison, King of the Beekeepers. Article begins, in the rush to find gold and strike it rich, John Harbison took a roundabout way to get there. Yes, he did travel to California in search of gold in 1854, but it was his cultivation of honey that made him rich and gave him the title King of the Beekeepers. In his lifetime, he developed a true understanding of nature's famous honeybee. According to a paper published in the Annual Review of Entomology in 2017, humans had been interacting with honeybees for at least 9,000 years. Before structured beekeeping was invented, people hunted for honey in the wild hives, similar to practices of modern chimpanzees. The first evidence of humans keeping bees comes from Egypt in 2450 BC, although the hieroglyphics that depict the process of beekeeping suggest that it was a passed down tradition that likely started earlier than 2450. Since bees are not really tamed or domesticated, the main difference between the agricultural practice of keeping bees and the wild hunting is in the man-made hive. The innovation of beehive construction has evolved drastically over history. Skeps, which were straw-woven and looked like overturned baskets, were widely used from the Middle Ages through the Victorian era. Gums, made from hollowed-out logs, typically around 3 feet long, named for the black gum tree that was mainly used, were utilized until the invention of the box hive in the early 1800s. When honeybee colonies, which are not native to North America, began arriving in Virginia in 1622 from England, they were in straw skeps, and the occasional wooden box hive or pottery vessel. By 1698, honeybee colonies made it to Pennsylvania, where two of the most influential beekeepers in history would eventually live, John Harbison and Lorenzo Longstreth. They each would make improvements on the box hive that revolutionized modern beekeeping. The Longstreth hive is widely used among beekeepers today. John Harbison and his brothers, William and Andrew, grew up raising bees with their father. The brothers continued to work together even after John moved to California. William worked to sell his brother's patented beehive on the eastern part of the United States. Andrew helped by building some of the first Harbison hives from his home in Illinois. Having been raised, as it were, in the apiary and instructed in the science of beekeeping from our earliest recollection, we were prepared to enter upon it with reasonable certainty of success when we set out to do business on our own account, wrote William Harbison. Despite this assuredness, he did not imagine his brother would one day be dubbed King of the Beekeepers, with the largest fleet of hives in the world. After losing half his hives in a drought, Harbison moved to Sacramento to mine for gold. It only took him a few weeks' worth of hard work with little return to quit that and return to what he knew best. He started slowly, first sending off for seeds from home to start a nursery. Those trees began the beginning of the orchards that lined the banks of the Sacramento River. It wasn't long before he sent home for his bees and began developing his hive. In 1859, Harbison patented his California hive, which had better ventilation, a removable bottom board for easy cleaning, and combined movable adjustable combs to allow for easy access to each individual comb. Better returns can be had from these hives than from those constructed on any other principle, not because the bees are any more industrious in this hive than others, but because the beekeeper can so control and manage his bees as to have them build all their brood combs straight and regular by equalizing his stocks to have all possible numbers of young bees in time for the honey harvest, having the greatest force when most needed, thereby saving valuable time. That was written by John's brothers, William Harbison, in a marketing circular for the hive. As an inventor as well as a beekeeper, John Harbison was meticulous. He was always thinking about how to improve his practices for a healthier, more fruitful hive. Harbison had been accused of infringing on Longstreth's design, but claimed that his design was really an improvement on Swiss beekeeper Francis Huber's design from the early 1800s. Harbison was also deeper than Longstreth, giving the bees a better distribution of heat. He felt his hive gave the colony a better chance of surviving during the winter. The California hive had another major advantage that allowed him to grow his empire: transportability. The ventilated porch allowed him to successfully ship bees from his hometown in Pennsylvania to the West Coast with minimal casualties. In 1859 alone, Harbison had grossed $30,000 in profits from selling bees and honey. This success set off bee fever, as the newspapers of the time called it. It was essentially a second gold rush, as somewhere between 7,000 and 10,000 hives were shipped to California. Newspapers from the time reported that every incoming steamship had beehives piled on the decks. This is still considered to be the greatest mass movement of bees in history. Though the market became diluted with the abundance of hives now available, Harbison had no trouble maintaining his success. He had built such a reputation that he could still sell his hives for $100 when others were now going for only $4. After spending 10 years as a beekeeper and starting a nursery in Sacramento, Harbison was invited to become a business partner with a Mr. R.G. Clark in San Diego County. He built a house there for his wife and daughter in a canyon now that is named for him. He quickly became the largest honey producer in the world. San Diego County began producing so much honey that the West Coast markets could no longer absorb it all. In 1878, for example, it was reported that 3 million pounds of honey were produced in the area. With the help from distributors like W.R. Strong and Company, Harbison began selling his comb honey nationwide, starting with a shipment to Chicago. His honey even spread beyond the United States of America. According to an article in 1884 in the Troy Times, the first honeybee ever to grace the table at Queen Victoria came from a Harbison apiary. Even though Europe had their own abundance of honey, California honey grew to have a reputation of being spicier and more flavorful than honey from other regions. When teamed up with Clark, the two discovered that mountain sages such as black or button sage gave their honey the best flavor. Harbison also noted that button bush, with its bulbous flowers, was supreme at attracting bees, nicknaming it the sugar plantation. Harbison's expertise went far beyond botanicals and hive construction. He had a vast scientific knowledge on the propagation of honeybees. He was a hard worker and did not believe in luck or superstition in regard to bees. It was his broad knowledge of both nature and business that led him to success. In 1860, he shared his wisdom with the world in his book, An Improved System of Propagating the Honeybee. He did so again the next year with the book, The Beekeeper's Directory, Theory and Practice of Bee Culture. His work inspired other prominent beekeepers to join the game, such as M.H. Mendelssohn and Neffy Miller, who pioneered the process of cross-country pollination. The introduction of commercial beekeeping in California vastly changed the agricultural industry in the West. It caused quite a bit of tension at first. Harbison himself made this comment in the American Bee Journal in 1889. "The introduction of beekeeping in this country is in a great measure destroyed the sheep and cattle business, and now in turn the fruit and vineyard industries have destroyed beekeeping over a large extent of the country." What he is referring to is the bitter disdain the fruit growers began to feel about beekeeping and the change in economy. Because of paranoia that the bees might be eating crops, it was not uncommon for a beekeeper to find his or her hives burned to the ground by another farmer. Harbison lost 350 hives to arson in 1889, despite evidence that bees were unable to penetrate unbroken skin on fruit. Today, many produce growers are dependent on honeybees. In 1885, after bee fever ended, the USDA finally began to seriously study apiculture and the role it plays in the food industry. Today, roughly 75% of all our crops rely on pollinators such as honeybees, wild bees, butterflies, moths, and bats. 30% of all North American food is dependent on bee pollination, specifically. This food, plus the production of honey and other byproducts, as well as seed production from pollinated plants, have a $16 billion value on the U.S. economy. There are also an estimated 135,000 beekeepers in the United States, making it a rather large industry with deep economic, social, and nutritional impacts on North America. There is no doubt that the introduction of honeybees have impacted both the biodiversity of North American wildlife and the agricultural industry in positive and negative ways. Today, honeybee populations are plagued by the four P's: parasites, pathogens, pesticides, and poor nutrition. At the same time, honeybees are being cited as one cause of wild bee decline as the groups compete for resources. We put fences up for our cows, and we manage how our cows graze, but very little is done to manage how honeybees are grazing across our landscape, said entomologist and wildlife ecologist Adrian Carper. We need to think about managing our habitats so we can support both honeybees and wild bees, but also to think about when and where we move honeybees and allow them to forage. Could Harbison have predicted the drastic effects honeybees have had on Western agriculture in less than 200 years? As O.C. Wheeler, the 1861 Secretary of California State Agricultural Society, wrote in the introduction of Harbison's second book, "On every page of history, we meet her name. In every volume of political economy or domestic industry, her diligence is the motto. In the sweetest strains of Parnassus, her cheerful hum is keynote everywhere and at all times. Her products have lightened the darkest hours of grief and sweetened the bitterest cups of human woe. While her industry has both urged and inspired men to higher aims and nobler achievements, surely the honeybee has changed history." That's the end of the story, written by Melissa Stark Rodenberg. And it was called Harbison's Honey, Liquid Gold in the West. That was in the History magazine, June, July 2019. We only have a little bit of time left, and we're going to do some historical trivia. These authors were all turned down before they became world famous. This is called First Rejected, Now Collected. I'll read two of them, give you some time to think about it and talk about it, and then come back and give you the answer, which you will probably already know. This book, Tom Clancy's First, was turned down by more than two dozen publishers before it became a huge bestseller. I'll read that again. This book, which was Tom Clancy's first book, was turned down by more than two dozen publishers before it became a huge bestseller. Think about that, talk about that, see who's got the right answer for that. The next one. This Southerner's first novel, turned down by 28 publishers, was called A Time to Kill. His next book was a bestseller. Who's the author? This Southerner's first novel, turned down by 28 publishers, was called A Time to Kill. His next book was a bestseller. Who are we talking about? Who's the author? Going back to that first one. Who's got the answer? This book, A Tom Clancy's First, was turned down by more than two dozen publishers before it became a huge bestseller. What are we talking about? What book is that? You're right. That's The Hunt for Red October. The Hunt for Red October is right. All right. Good one. Who's got this next one? This Southerner's first novel, turned down by 28 publishers, was called A Time to Kill. His next book was a bestseller. Who's the author? Who we're talking about? That would be, yes, that would be John Grisham. And we have one final one. Who's got the answer to this one? Irving Stone's biographical novel of Vincent van Gogh was rejected by 17 publishers over 3 years. What was the title of the book? Irving Stone's biographical novel of Vincent van Gogh was rejected by 17 publishers over 3 years. What was the title? And the title is Lust for Life. Lust for Life. And I believe that is all the time that we have today, and we appreciate your listening. If you ever have any suggestions or questions, give us a call. But until next time, this is Bill Vondahar with Moments in History. Thank you.